Iran's parliament overwhelmingly approves a bill aimed at tackling sanctions in what is described as the first practical response to the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist. A British think tank says nearly 700,000 Britons, including 120,000 kids, have fallen into poverty due to COVID-19. And French President Emmanuel Macron says his country won't accept a Brexit deal that does not respect its long-term interests. Hi, this is World News from Tehran. I'm Erzan Tafi. Good to have you with us. Iranian lawmakers have overwhelmingly approved a bill that's aimed at tackling the illegal sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic. The bill requires the government to produce and store 120 kilos of uranium enriched at a 20% purity level in 2 months. It also calls for making use of advanced centrifuges. Parliament Speaker Mohammad Davar Ghalibaf says the endorsement sends Iranian enemies the message that a one-sided game has come to an end. Lawmakers pushed for the bill after multiple rounds of U.S. sanctions following its withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. The bill follows the Friday assassination of eminent Iranian nuclear and defense scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh.
As the people and officials of Iran turned out to pay their respects to the assassinated nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the evidence surrounding the murder began to come to light as more and more clues began to emerge about the circumstances that led up to the killing. Various voices have sent messages of condolences to Iran, as well as to the family and friends of Fakhrizadeh, coupled with strong words of condemnation over the assassination by the likes of the European Union, Hamas, Hezbollah, as well as countries like the United Arab Emirates, China, Jordan, and the UK. Yet again, in circumstances similar to the assassination of Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, or Arbitrary Executions has stated that the assassination of Fakhrizadeh constituted as an extrajudicial killing, suggesting foul play was at the heart of the act. It seems that further evidence has emerged that following the information revealed to Press TV, indications are pointing towards equipment being used in the attack originating from the Israeli regime's arsenal, with senior Iranian officials also stating that the technology used to commit the act was complicated and used remote devices, raising the question as to why the global arena is not calling for this crime to be investigated.
Israelis, they have the capacity and expertise in this. They have done it before. They have assassinated, with the help of the United States, some other Iranian scientists. And they have the motivation. They can gain from this assassination. So there are many reasons to say that Israelis, maybe with the help of Americans, they have done it. Whether other countries, including some of their Arab allies, are also involved in this or not, that's the question. And I think after the investigation and official conclusion, we might be hearing about this from Iranian officials. And according to that conclusion, I think we might be seeing a reaction from Iranian side.
As usual, the Israeli regime has remained eerily silent over the assassination, suggesting by the silence that they have too much to hide, which is not uncommon, as the regime have remained coy on numerous occasions in the past when it comes to the assassination of targets by the Zionist regime. Yet even if the Israelis are not responsible for pulling the trigger, the apparent use of satellite technology to activate the devices used clearly shows some notion of state-sponsored activity and likely sees the Israeli regime's criminal counterparts from the MEK also play a part in the logistics and execution of the act in Iran, something that again bears all the common denominators of a Zionist plot.
Well, Ali Champani, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, says that remote control equipment were used in that operation. He says no perpetrators were at the scene, accusing the anti-Iran MKO or MEK terrorist organization of having a role in that attack without elaborating. The terrorist attack has pushed the West Asia region to the brink once again. Iranians believe that the Tel Aviv regime and its backer, Washington, are trying to intensify pressure on Iran in a bid to trigger a full-fledged war.
Tension appears to have risen in the recent weeks following the US elections, especially in parts of West Asia, where traditional allies to the US have started to express concerns that they'll not receive preferential treatment during the next US government's term in office. The emerging evidence that shows the weaponry used in the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh had the hallmarks of Israeli origin suggests that the murder was not solely aimed at stopping the Islamic Republic of Iran pursuing its legitimate and peaceful civilian nuclear program, but was really an act of extreme provocation. A recent meeting in the Saudi region of Neom between Mike Pompeo, Benjamin Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman, which has been denied by some, suggests that the planned assassination of Fakhrizadeh was discussed at the meeting, putting the three states on high alert prior to the action. With all three regimes opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran, the notion of no smoke without fire has never been truer when it comes to this sensitive issue. Was it then the Israeli regime that masterminded the assassination, gaining a nod from its friends along the way? Iran's reaction has been one vowing revenge for the assassination of the esteemed nuclear scientist. Yet, revenge for Iran does not necessarily mean in a like-for-like form of self-defense. For Iran, the most powerful form of revenge could come in the form of a diplomatic card, with the Iranian president Hassan Rouhani, for one, stating that Iran is far too wise to fall into the trap set by the Zionist regime to provoke Iran into starting a conflict.
I think Iran is in a situation whereby assumes any reaction or response to this assassination inevitable, because if it doesn't respond, it will make the other side to advance further, and that will encourage them to do further assassinations or actions against Iran. But any serious response also might have a risk of, let's say, chain of actions or reaction which might end in a conflict in the region.
With diplomacy on the table, the most painful strike to the murderous Zionist regime would be showing the world that as a peace-loving nation, the pen is mightier than the sword.
Well, the EU has described the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist as a criminal act, but it stopped short of pointing the finger at Israel for that atrocity. One EU lawmaker told Press TV that the murder last Friday was designed to stifle the efforts to pursue diplomacy with Iran. Jerome Hughes has more.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States. But also, trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal?
Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Time now for the news review. Do stay with us. Welcome to the news review. Data compiled by a British think tank shows nearly 700,000 Britons have fallen to poverty due to the economic crisis caused by COVID-19. According to Legatum Institute, an educational charity, 120,000 of those economically hit were children. The coronavirus pandemic will push the number of poor people in the UK to more than 15 million. That accounts for 23% of the total population. The data shows, however, that government relief measure in April prevented another 700,000 Brits from falling into poverty. The study indicates the uneven spread of economic fallout of COVID-19 among different groups, with low-income workers being the most vulnerable. The UK is among the hardest-hit European countries by the pandemic, with more than 58,000 fatalities and 1.6 million infections so far. Now let's get some insight on this and discuss a little bit. So join me will be our own site, tour designer, London Bureau, and also from Brussels we have Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation. Good to see you both. Welcome to the show. Said, these are horrible statistical figures and numbers in terms of poverty levels in the UK, aren't they?
They certainly are, Beruz, and it's great to be with you as well. As you just said, 120,000 children among the 700,000 estimate by Legatum Institute in the world's sixth largest economy. And it's happening at a time when the government just over the past month announced that it was injecting billions of pounds into the military. So there is money, but apparently it's being spent in different other places, and these children do not seem to be the priority. Organizations and charities involved in providing essentials to the poor, and some of these new people who have fallen into poverty are being referred to as the newly poor, the newly hungry, people who used to have decent incomes but then lost their livelihoods and now are having to rely on food banks. I'll get to that in a minute. So those charities are saying that the government should have a comprehensive anti-poverty strategy at the very heart of its response to COVID-19, and it doesn't seem to be the case just yet. It's not that the government hasn't helped at all. It has. It has given people, for example, a £20 a week handout to try and help them make ends meet, but it has not been adequate, obviously. The hunger crisis is the result of the pandemic, no doubt, but then also the way the government has gone about responding to the pandemic. And so it has hit different groups of people differently, in particular in young people have been hit the hardest, people who work in, for example, the hospitality sector, people who work in retail and entertainment, and low-paid jobs, or people who work zero-hour contracts. So those are the people who have been really hit the hardest. And as I said earlier, these people used to have decent enough incomes, but now they're not able to make ends meet because of the two lockdowns that the government has introduced since the pandemic hit, as well as the oppressive restrictions that it introduced, the tiered system and all that, over the past year. But one more point. Britain's largest food bank network, the Trussell Trust, which has over 1,300 emergency food distribution centers on its network, predicted this 2 months ago when it warned the UK, the government, that the destitution rates in the country would double by Christmas, alongside the explosion in demand for charity food packages. But not much seems to have been done so far.
I see. Okay. Now let's go to Brussels. Paolo, you know, given all the problems that the UK is facing, and it's also, you know, engaged in the final days of talks on future trade ties with the EU, and the stumbling blocks still remain there. We have the pandemic in place. So will we be forecasting to see more and more Britons get poorer and poorer?
Well, what we see in Britain happening is not only because of the COVID-19. COVID-19 has been a catalyzer of a situation which was just under the surface of the situation in the UK, and not only in the UK. Look at the United States and the rest of the Western countries. They all find extremely difficult to manage a situation which has become socially and economically explosive. And this is the outcome of several decades of neoliberal recipes that have been implemented in all these countries, fragilizing basically the life of a large portion of the society. And so the COVID-19 has just made it explode. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like it is the virus fault, but the virus has just simply taken off this carpet covering up the surface.
Right. Paolo, what is it that the Boris Johnson administration can do in order to kind of address this issue to the best of their ability?
The only thing is to try to distribute money, helicopter money, to try to reduce the suffering of those people who have been thrown out of the economic cycle because of the pandemic, and probably these people is not certain they will ever return into any future economic cycle, because we have to be honest, I mean, things will not return exactly as they were.
Okay, I appreciate your comments and contributions. Said Pureza joined me from the London Bureau. I'm Paolo Rofone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation out of Brussels. Thank you for staying tuned. The French president says that Paris won't accept a Brexit deal if it does not respect France's long-term interests. Emmanuel Macron says that France is paying a particular attention to negotiations between the EU and the UK on trade and fishing rights. Now, those comments were made as Britain said that it will continue trade talks with the bloc throughout the week. London saying that the two sides are working hard to bridge their differences. Britain formally left the EU in January, but remains bound by bloc rules until transition period ends by the end of December. The two sides are discussing future relations, but they have remained deadlocked over a number of key issues. The United Nations says that 1 in 33 people around the world will need humanitarian aid next year due to the coronavirus pandemic. The figure will amount to 235 million people. That's a 40% increase from the number of people in need of aid in 2020. The UN says hunger, conflicts, and climate change have made the situation worse. There is also a risk of famine in countries like Syria, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Yemen. The UN is appealing for more funding by wealthier countries. It says it has raised only half of the $35 billion funding required to reach out to those in need. The number of COVID-19 infections in Iran is approaching the grim milestone of 1 million. Health Ministry spokeswoman says that the daily infection cases rose to around 976,000. She added that 382 more people also died of disease in one day, and that brings the total fatalities to over 48,600. The spokeswoman also said that 678,000 people have managed to recover from the disease. The Iranian government has implemented restrictions throughout the country to curb the spread of the killer virus. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
a diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we discussed Imam Khomeini's style of teaching in brief. We said that he was very humble in hearing to the criticism of his students and also encouraged them to have a critical spirit rather than accepting what is taught very easily. However, he would never let anyone waste the time of the class for trivial and lengthy debates. It is vital for teaching to have three features to be effective. First, teaching should be based on a specific aim. The teacher should know what he is seeking and where he wants to reach. Secondly, there should be a reciprocal relation between the teacher and the student. Unilateral teaching and monologue is rarely effective and fruitful. The student should be involved in the course of teaching. Thirdly, the teacher should provide easy and suitable opportunities for learning to enable the student to learn the material in the easiest way. Experts of education have divided teaching techniques into four categories. The first technique is teaching based on direct conveying of information. The second technique is based on interaction and involvement. The third one is problem-oriented, and the fourth one is individual teaching. Although it is not simple to refer one of these techniques over others, experts maintain that the interactive technique is the best and most successful method. The interactive technique is characterized by active teaching. In this method, the activity of the learner or student is highly emphasized. This is why it is also called active method technique. In other words, the student has a very active role in class. He or she participates in discussions and raises his or her view on various issues, trying to solve problems. He or she gathers experiences from the teacher and is guided by the teacher. The teacher does not behave as a superior authority, but as a guide and director. This method leads to thriving of creativity and talents of students rather than bringing up lethargic and passive students. Imam Khomeini's method of teaching was very active and discussion-oriented. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat said, When the Imam raised an issue for discussion, both Arab and non-Arab ulema would come. Imam Khomeini would let them debate. Some would say that he hadn't had this method in Qom and had started it in Najaf. He would allow debates in public sessions. Sometimes the Imam himself would participate in the discussion so that even students like me could debate with him. But if there was a debate among friends, he would keep silent and listen unless when his opinion was asked. Then he would participate in the debate. His method was quite honorable and vital for us. Dear listeners, one of the factors that make classes non-interactive is the scientific vanity of the teacher. Scientific vanity prevents active participation of students in scientific debates and blocks the way of progress. According to all of his classmates and students, Imam Khomeini was devoid of any scientific vanity, and this had made his classes the most active classes among seminaries. Ayatollah Qadiri says, "The Imam would show no negative reaction to good words. He was never seen to have scientific vanity towards his knowledge. He would say, maybe this is correct, maybe that is correct." Late Ayatollah Abdul Karim Musavi Ardabili said, "Imam Khomeini never had scientific vanity. In his books, he would not use phrases or words to denote that he had plunged in scientific vanity to have the connotation that nobody could understand as much as he could." Dear friends, Imam Khomeini was a good listener to the audience of his words, especially those who would object his words and writings. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Zanjani said, "Anyone who talked at the Imam's class, even the young students who were raising an objection, the Imam would give them opportunity and would listen to them. This would train the students in this way. I have seen this characteristic in Imam Khomeini's class and even his ordinary dealings. When someone wanted to tell him something, he would listen to him exactly and with full attention." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, used to teach in a way to bring up his students self-confident. Ayatollah Mazahiri says, "The Prophet of Islam would behave with his companions in a way that each of them thought that he was the dearest for him." Imam Khomeini was like this in his teaching. He would regard his students with high esteem so that their talents would flourish. He would accept a good word and thank for it. Ayatollah Muwahhidi Kermani says, "Imam Khomeini taught in Masjid-e-Azam, that is the great mosque in Qom. At the end of the class, he would sit for a while and people would gather around him. I raised the objection that I had in my mind. The Imam was silent for a short while. Then he said, 'I have to think.' This is very humble. In these cases, professors usually give an answer immediately so that their scientific status is not hurt before the student. But the Imam showed humbleness and said, 'I have to think.'" Dear listeners, next time we will continue this discussion.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the reality of unity and divine justice. The principle of God's existence is clear and manifest for us, and any particle from particles of this world points to His dignity, power, knowledge, and ability. On the other hand, the reality of His existence is hidden from us because He is an infinite existence and beyond our understanding. So we should consider His essence to be beyond whatsoever we may imagine. And this is the reality of unity. Events occur in the world whose underlying mystery is not always known to us. Belief in God's justice says to us that all of these events are backed by sound reasons, and any suspicion in this regard is not in conformity with belief in His justice and wisdom. So, we think that we know our Creator. We think that we have the ma'rifah of our Creator, the in-depth recognition of our Creator. Well, know that that unity is not that simple for us to understand. Not that it cannot be understood at all. No, it can. But we need to know that our intellect has limitations, whereas the existence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is unlimited. So, the limited being, which is our intellect, cannot really comprehend the infinite being, which is the existence of Allah. That said, we still can attain a good level of understanding and recognition of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is expected from all of us. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the reality of unity of Allah and His divine justice. Well, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, reality of unity of Allah indicates that one shall not define His essence according to one's imaginations. And belief in His justice infers that one shall not accuse Him in any work. Brothers and sisters, can the human mind comprehend the reality of Allah's essence? Does the human brain possess the ability to fathom the reality of Allah's essence? Well, Allah's essence is beyond whatsoever we may imagine. And this is the reality of unity. Accusing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in any form and shape implies that His wisdom and justice is being challenged. And hence, once we accept that He is the One and we consider His actions to be perfect, there is no room left for any disobedience. So I know it's a little heavy concept for us to digest, but understand and realize this, that Allah is just. Allah is wise. Allah doesn't do any oppression. Once we get to the logical proof of these concepts, there is no room left for anyone to challenge Allah's authority, Allah's justice. Okay? These need to be proven first, and once we get to the proof of these concepts, we understand that Allah is the only just being. He is the Adil, Adil-e-Mutlaq, right? So this is what the message of today's lesson was. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Hello everyone and welcome to the program. The article you're about to hear has been authored by Dennis Overby and carries the title, Can a Computer Devise a Theory of Everything? Stay with us for more of Dennis Overby's article. Might be possible, physicists say, but not anytime soon, and there's no guarantee that we humans will understand the result. Once upon a time, Albert Einstein described scientific theories as free inventions of the human mind. But in 1980, Stephen Hawking, the Cambridge University cosmologist, had another thought. In a lecture that year, he argued that the so-called theory of everything might be achievable, but that the final touches on it were likely to be done by computers. The theory of everything is still not in sight, but with computers taking over many of the chores in life, translating languages, recognizing faces, driving cars, it is not so crazy to imagine them taking over from the Hawkings and the Einsteins of the world. Computer programs keep discovering new ways to beat humans at games like chess, which have been studied and played for centuries. Why couldn't one of these marvelous learning machines let loose on an enormous astronomical catalogue or the petabytes of data, discern a set of new fundamental particles or discover a wormhole to another galaxy in the outer solar system? At least that's the dream. To think otherwise is to engage in what the physicist Max Tegmark calls carbon chauvinism. In November, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where Dr. Tegmark is a professor, cashed a check from the National Science Foundation and opened the metaphorical doors of the new Institute for Artificial Intelligence and fundamental interactions. The Institute is one of seven set up as part of an effort to galvanize work in artificial intelligence. The MIT-based Institute, directed by Jesse Thaler, a particle physicist, is the only one specifically devoted to physics. It includes more than 24 scientists from all areas of physics, from MIT, Harvard, Northwestern University, and Tufts. What I'm hoping to do is to create a venue where researchers from a variety of different fields of physics, as well as researchers who work on computer science, machine learning, or artificial intelligence, can come together and have dialogue and teach each other things, Dr. Thaler said. Ultimately, I want to have machines that can think like a physicist. Their tool in this endeavor is a brand of artificial intelligence known as neural networks. Unlike so-called expert systems like IBM's Watson, which are loaded with human and scientific knowledge, neural networks are designed to learn as they go, similar to the way human brains do. By analyzing vast amounts of data for hidden patterns, they swiftly learn to distinguish dogs from cats, recognize faces, replicate human speech, flag financial misbehavior, and much more. We're hoping to discover all kinds of new laws of physics, Dr. Tegmark said. We have already shown that it can rediscover laws of physics. Last year, in what amounted to a sort of proof of principle, Dr. Tegmark and a student, Silviu Marian Udrescu, took 100 physics equations from a famous textbook and used them to generate data that was then fed to a neural network. The system sifted the data for patterns and regularities, and recovered all 100 formulas. Like a human scientist, it tries many different strategies, modules in turn, the researchers wrote in a paper published last year in Science Advances. And if it cannot solve the full problem in one fell swoop, it tries to transform it and divide it into simpler pieces that can be tackled separately, recursively relaunching the full algorithm on each piece. In another more challenging experiment, Dr. Tegmark and his colleagues showed the network a video of rockets flying around and asked it to predict what would happen from one frame to the next. Never mind the palm trees in the background, at the end the computer was able to discover the essential equations of motion, he said. Finding new particles at a place like CERN's Large Hadron Collider would be a cinch, Dr. Tegmark said. Artificial intelligence likes big data, and the collider data runs to thousands of terabytes a second. Never mind that a new particle hasn't appeared in the CERN data since the discovery of the Higgs boson in 2012, despite years of frenzied examinations of every bump in the data stream. Those are curves that humans look at, Dr. Tegmark said. In 10 years, machine learning will be an essential to doing physics as knowing mathematics. For now, he conceded, there are limits to what can be achieved by the algorithm's recursive methods of problem solving, a practice known as regression. Although the machine can retrieve from a pile of data the fundamental laws of physics, it cannot yet come up with the deep principles, like quantum uncertainty in quantum mechanics or relativity, that underlie those formulae. By the time that artificial intelligence comes back and tells you that then we have reached artificial general intelligence, and you should be very scared or very excited, depending on your point of view, Dr. Tegmark said. The reason I'm working on this, honestly, is because what I find most menacing is if we build super powerful artificial intelligence computers and have no clue how it works, right? Dr. Thaler, who directs the new institute at MIT, said, he was once a skeptic about artificial intelligence, but now was an evangelist. He realized that a physicist, he could encode some of his knowledge into the machine, which could then give answers that could interpret more easily. That becomes a dialogue between human and machine in a way that becomes more exciting, he said, rather than just having a black box you don't understand making decisions for you. He added, I don't particularly like calling these techniques artificial intelligence, since that language masks the fact that many artificial intelligence techniques have rigorous underpinnings in mathematics, statistics, and computer science. Yes, he noted, the machine can find very much better solutions than he can despite all of his training. But ultimately, I still get to decide what concrete goals are worth accomplishing, and I can aim at ever more ambitious targets, knowing that if I can rigorously define my goals in a language the computer understands, then artificial intelligence can deliver powerful solutions. Recently, Dr. Thala and his colleagues fed their neural network a trove of data from the Large Hadron Collider, which smashes together protons in search of new particles and new forces. Protons, the building blocks of atomic matter, are themselves bags of smaller entities called quarks and gluons. When protons collide, these smaller particles squirt out in jets, along with whatever other exotic particles have coalesced out of the energy of the collision. To better understand this process, he and his team asked the system to distinguish between the quarks and the gluons in the collider data. We said, I'm not going to tell you something about quantum field theory. I'm not going to tell you what a quark or gluon is at a fundamental level, he said. I'm just going to say, here's a mess of data, please separate it into basically two categories. And it can do that. That is, the system successfully identified and distinguished between quarks and gluons without ever knowing what either was. If you then ask the system if there is a third kind of object in that data, Dr. Thala said, it starts to discover that quarks are not just one entity but exist in different types, so-called up quarks and down quarks. And so it starts to, like, learn as you give it more flexibility to explore, he said. It doesn't know quantum field theory yet, but it knows to look for patterns. And that is a pattern that I was shocked that the machine would find. The work, he added, would help collider physicists untangle their results. Some physicists believe that the next great leap will come with the advent of artificial intelligence on quantum computers. Unlike classical computers, which manipulate bits of data that can be one or zero, the so-called qubits in quantum computers can be both at once. According to quantum physics, that is how elementary particles behave on the smaller scales of nature, and it allows quantum computers to process vast amounts of information simultaneously. Such machines are still in their infancy, but they hold great promise, said Seth Lloyd, a mechanical engineer and quantum computing expert at MIT, who is not part of this new artificial intelligence institute. The basic insight is that quantum systems can generate patterns that are hard for classical systems to generate, Dr. Seth Lloyd said. So maybe quantum systems can also recognize patterns that classical systems recognize. Maria Spiropoulou, a physicist at the California Institute of Technology, pointed to the growing literature on quantum artificial intelligence and quantum-inspired algorithms that solve problems that we thought of as unsolvable previously. How far this could go depends on whom you ask. Could a machine produce the abstrusive and unintuitive principles of quantum theory, or Einstein's bulwark principles of relativity? Could it produce a theory that we humans can't understand? Steven Weinberg, a professor of physics at the University of Texas at Austin, called it a troubling thought that humans might not be smart enough to understand the final theory of everything. But Steven Weinberg said, "I suspect in that case, we will also not be smart enough to design a computer that can find a final theory of everything." Lisa Randall, a physicist at Harvard University, wrote, "I can readily imagine computers finding equations or relationships we don't know how to interpret, but that is not really different from the many measurements we cannot yet explain." Edward Witten, from the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton University, noted that although a theory of everything machine didn't exist yet, it might in the next century. If there were a machine that appeared to be interested in and curious about physics, I would certainly be interested in conversing with it.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Basically, the front lines were a place where you could easily see sincerity and warmth. Everyone had a friendly relationship with others. In that arena, some people practiced sincerity and showed their divine intentions in action. We can also refer to their spiritual qualities, their midnight tears, their dawn prayers, their monotheistic enthusiasm and love, and their indifference to material trifles and in certain cases, we witnessed their connection with Alamul Ghaib, the unseen world. Some of those dear ones and those mystic youth, mystic in the true sense of the word, had developed such spirituality in the front lines that they could see and predict the future. They could see their martyrdom, the martyrdom of their comrades, and the event that would happen. These points exist in soldiers' biographies, and they are really important.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, it is evident that the last point existed more than the others, thanks to Islam. Of course, prominence in other areas existed thanks to religious faith as well. But in particular, the last point originated from entrusting one's heart to God, to Islam, and to religious faith. One becomes really astonished at the effect of such deep faith. For example, martyrs' mothers had such deep faith. Well, you and I do not understand motherly affection at all. No one except for mothers themselves can really understand motherly feelings. However, these mothers sent their youth to the front lines. When their children went to them to ask for their permission, they responded, "Because you are going there for the sake of Islam, you may go." When they brought them the bodies of their youth, they expressed their joy at having offered them in the way of God.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.